Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
Welcome on into Tuesday's edition of Kildare Focus. In just a moment, we'll be talking about a new report by the Royal College of Psychiatrists showing a very, very sharp and steep increase in the number of young people hospitalised with cannabis-related diagnoses over a 12-year period. Marie Conlon is chairperson of the Kildare branch of the Alzheimer's Society. The branch found out recently after leaving their building that they could no longer return to hold their cafe there, and they're looking for your help. I'll be joined by Dr. Oran McCarthy. He's Director of Social Anxiety Ireland, and we will be discussing how people can cope as we emerge from the pandemic. Emma Duffy is a journalist at the42.ie. We'll be discussing the scenes at Old Trafford over the weekend. And I'll be joined by Kildare North Sinn Féin TD Raida Cronin, who is raising concerns about a disparity between a reply she got from the HSE and figures released in the Irish Independent yesterday pertaining to the number of pregnant women contracting COVID between the first wave and the third wave. As always, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with your comments, your requests, your dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97. You can drop us an email, studio@kfmradio.com, or you can tweet us at KFM Radio.
Your station, your music. KFM.
The College of Psychiatrists of Ireland has released a report showing a 400% increase in the number of hospital admissions of young people related to cannabis-related diagnoses over a 12-year period between 2005 and 2017. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Professor Mary Cannon. She's Professor of Psychiatric Epidemiology and Youth Mental Health at the Royal College of Psychiatrists. Mary, you're very welcome.
Hello, Ciara.
This is a deeply concerning report, but I suppose for context, it might be reasonable to state that cannabis available on the market, if you're to refer to it as a market, in 2005 was probably quite a different animal to that cannabis being sold in 2017.
Yes, indeed. And that is part of our concern and part of the reason that the College of Psychiatrists are issuing this report today. The cannabis level, the THC levels, which is tetrahydrocannabidiol, it's the potent form of cannabis which is responsible for addiction and the high that you get from cannabis, that has increased dramatically over the years from, you know, over the past decade. So it used to be about 1 or 2% several decades ago, and now it's well over 10%, 16%, 20%. And this is what we call the potency. So the potency has increased, and this is responsible for many of the harms that we're concerned about.
And what are those harms, Mary?
Well, in terms of young people, there are three main harms. One is addiction, and young people, 1 in 3 young people who use cannabis weekly are now at risk of addiction. And then the other harm would be mental health concerns, which is a particular concern of mine. So cannabis use in young people will lead to psychosis. You're a 5-fold increased risk of psychotic illness or drug-induced psychosis with the high-potency cannabis. Also increases in anxiety and increases in suicidal behaviour. Suicide attempts and completed suicides have been shown from studies worldwide, a 3-fold increase. And the third set of risks that, again, we're very concerned about are effects on brain development and just cognition, you know, the brain functioning. So we're seeing drop in IQ. A study that I was involved in recently showed a 2-point drop in IQ for young people who use cannabis through adolescence. And some studies have shown drops of up to 8 points for those who continue to use heavily.
And Mary, you joined me on the publication of that particular study, and it was very interesting that its effects on the younger brain, the older adolescents and I suppose younger adults were particularly acute.
Yes, yes, and thank you for highlighting this. I really appreciate that you do draw attention to these facts. Cannabis is particularly, I'll say the word toxic, because that's for what it is. It is damaging to the developing brain. And we have to remember, brains keep developing up to the age of 25. It doesn't stop when you're a child. So cannabis interferes with the endocannabinoid system, which is quite a very important system for brain development. And you know, we don't know exactly how this is working yet, but we do see the effects on devices. So all the harms of cannabis are particularly concentrated in young people, and that's what we are concerned about, because they are the most vulnerable. Not just adolescents now, we're talking about young adults also.
How best, short of cutting off supply completely, which one would imagine on a logistical basis is impossible, but how best can this be countered or responded to, these three pillars of difficulty and experience?
Well, what college psychiatrists have, you know, we have thought about this, and we think one important part of this is public education and highlighting the risks, because and that's where, you know, the media are playing their part in highlighting this. Also, the problem is there's a lot of misinformation about cannabis, and as the risks are going up, as the cannabis is getting more potent and more frequent and more available, the perception of cannabis as harmful is going down. So we've got two opposing trends which are very dangerous.
I suppose for in many areas of society and information, it's very difficult for us to get rid of stereotypes. And one of the stereotypes attaching to cannabis probably stems from its introduction into broader society, 50s, 60s, 70s, when it was a particular kind of drug. It probably wasn't addictive. I don't have enough pharmacochemical knowledge to be able to categorically state that. But it may as well have been a fundamentally different substance in the 60s as that available today, yet the perception of cannabis gleaned during that period remains.
Yes, exactly, and that is the key dilemma that we have, because cannabis, the two important compounds of cannabis are CBD, which I think everyone's familiar with, is cannabidiol, that's now appearing in these health food shops, and THC, the one I mentioned earlier, which is the dangerous substance. That balance is shifting quite dramatically in favour of more THC. So the CBD, the cannabis you're talking about way back in the 60s and, you know, the Woodstock years, that had a lot more CBD, which is more sedating and less addictive. And now there's much less CBD, and it can't counterbalance the THC. So what we're seeing is a very, very toxic product. And some, you know, we're talking about over 10% THC is called high potent cannabis, but it's regularly 20% now in some states in the US. And in fact, there was a report in the news today of young children eating sweets, cannabis sweets, and having to be hospitalized. Mm. And then these can be up to 90% THC, these gummy sweets that they get that are available in states that have legalized in the US.
And that's what I was going to say. An awful lot of younger people, or people who engage particularly with Instagram, might be extremely familiar with these edible cannabis sweets. And it was the Food Safety Authority of Ireland that issued a warning on these products last week. But they seem, certainly with the haze and filter of social media over them, to be relatively harmless, and therefore you can understand why people in Ireland might consider ordering them.
Of course, they look like jellies. You know, they're in bright colours, and they're in the shape of bears. And of course, they look harmless. But these things are incredibly dangerous. And they've shown rates of child poisonings have increased, you know, exponentially in the US from these children getting hold of these sweets that I presume they're adults have brought into the house, because they're not buying them themselves. So I have no idea why people are making these products, because they look to me like they're meant for children, even though, you know,
they're not.
They're incredibly dangerous for them. Yeah.
Well, Professor Mary Cannon, Professor of Psychiatric Epidemiology and Youth Mental Health at the Royal College of Psychiatrists in Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us to share the results of that report. Now, I'm joined on the line by Mary Conlon. She's chairperson of the Kildare branch of the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland. Mary, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara, and thanks for giving me this opportunity.
Not at all. Tell us what's happening.
Well, I want to speak about two things. First is the Tea Day, which is coming up now on Thursday, next the 6th of May. And it's one of the major fundraising events for the national office. And they provide services throughout the country. So I want everybody to have their little cup of tea and donate to the organisation to help support by having the tea and donating to teaday.ie or text T-Day 50300 and today 4 euro.
50300, did you say, Mari?
Yeah, to donate 4 euro.
And obviously, we'll remind everybody closer to May 6th, which is what, Thursday?
It's Thursday. Now, also, I have put buckets in different shops. They've been kind enough to take a bucket, and I could give out their names quickly, like T.G. O'Mahony of Prosperous, Whelan's Pharmacy in Kildare, Long's Pharmacy in Newbridge, James in Super Value in Newbridge, and Parks in Kilcullen. They have buckets that people can't actually physically use the internet to donate. They could visit to any one of them places.
So look, one location in Prosperous, one in Kildare Town, two in Newbridge, and one in Kilcullen. Now, Mari, you have a bit of a crisis on your hands with the daycare
centre.
I
have a crisis in our own here place here. If I can explain exactly what a daycare centre is. It's a great place that brings hours of activities from 10 until 4 a.m. to people with family members suffering with Alzheimer's. Now, we managed to buy our own bus a few years ago, and the bus travels out daily from the home of the clients, collects them, brings them back to the centre, and then brings them home again for 4 p.m. And when they arrive, they're greeted with a cup of tea, they have their dinner, their midday meal, and refreshments again before they go home tired but happy.
It's a home away from home, I would imagine, Mari. It's a home away from home.
It is a home away from home, and there's wonderful benefits to it as well. It gives the primary carer hours of freedom to carry out the work they need to do, knowing that their loved one is safe and happy. And it provides hours of therapeutic care for the people. And it gives the person more energy to cope with the day-to-day living with a person with Alzheimer's, the 24-hour care they need to have. Now, our problem is, since last summer, our committee here in Kildare, along with Mary Barden, Operational Manager for the South East, we've been actively searching for apprentices with no success. So, what I'm doing here today is appealing to the public to help us identify such a building. I'm trying to find a place in a town, or preferably in a town or on the edge of a town of either Monastereven, Kildare, or Newbridge, or Naas. Now, the importance of that is, like, staff that will work in this daycare centre, they need ease of access for transport. So,
And, Mari, is there a particular kind of building you need? Does it need to be a certain size? Does it need to be accessible?
Well, if someone was good enough to donate us a site that we could build our own permanent daycare centre, that would be brilliant. And we'd have our own little sensory garden and all. But look, I don't believe in miracles. So what we do need is, now we've been renting like for the last 20 years, but what we do need is it's quite big, it's a 2,000 square foot building, because we need different rooms. Like, you need a kitchen and you need a storeroom, a room where the activities go on. And we also want a little garden, it's so a sensory garden. So I'd be grateful if anyone can help identify something, a building like that size.
And I know 2,000 square foot, when you're, equating it to a standard family home, sounds very big. But in the grand scheme of things, you wouldn't need a vast site for a building of that scale.
No, a small half-acre site would be a miracle. And that's the truth. Because we could design it ourselves then and get it up and have our own permanent daycare centre. And it's really something that's badly needed in Kildare and probably every county in Ireland. But it's hard to get and it's hard to find a suitable premises. And every time we move to a new place, we've been moving now about 5 or 6 times in the last 20 years.
That's a lot when you have to pack up everything that's in the centre, advise all of your staff, advise everybody
who the service users
and the clients and their families. That's a lot of jiggery pokery, really.
It is, and it's very, very hard. But it's just very difficult to find a suitable premises, And like I said, the ideal thing would be to have our own place, but in the meantime, like, all we can do is just try and hope we can get somewhere. Because, you see, when these restrictions lift now, and it probably might be a few more months before the Alzheimer's clients can gather together again, but...
You want to be ready.
We want to be ready. This is it. And, like, if we don't, we're all in lockdown. We're all looking forward to getting out of lockdown, going here, going there. But for a family carer living with a person with Alzheimer's, that lockdown will still be there.
Mm.
Like, they will have no reprieve at all. So I really, really, I need help. Like, I've tried along with Mary and our own committee here, members have been great, but it's just very, very hard to identify a suitable place.
And Mary, are you fearful that you won't find a building or a site?
I am, of course I am, because I just seem to be hitting brick walls and trying to find a place. Like, since last summer I've been going around, like, because, you know, the way it was in the beginning there, we thought it'll end this month, we thought it'll end next month, so I've been actively looking the whole time and basically getting nowhere to find, it's just such a difficult task to try and find a suitable premises, but and I just thought by appealing maybe.
And you've cast your neck wide in fairness, Mary, because there's an awful lot of land and buildings betwixt Monasterevin and Kildare Town, Newbridge and Naas.
Yeah, but I've gone around trying to identify a place. An awful lot of buildings like are used by other charitable organisations, and running into that there. You see, ours is so specific because we do need a place with different rooms for different activities, you know, and we need a little garden. Some places, like I looked at, have no garden. The garden is an essential part of helping people with their stimulation.
And have you been on to the council at all, Mary?
The council and the HSE have been very, very good, I must say. But again, they're meeting the same sort of. I want to thank the HSE for their help. But if anybody out there can help in any way at all.
And if they can help, Mary, how will they let you know?
Well, Mary Barden, she'd be our operational manager here in the South East, and I can give you her phone number, and she's happy to take a call, or myself even. But Mary's number is 086 043 8238.
And she'd be the first port of call. And of course, Mary, if anybody gets in touch with us, we'll pass their details on to you. Certainly a really, really pressing plea. And if anybody out there has land or a building that even might be suitable, get in touch with us. We'll let Mary know. That's Mary Conlon, chairperson of the Kildare branch of the Alzheimer's Society. Certainly between a rock and a hard place, they're trying to put preparations in place for the return of their clients and of their staff to that very much needed service. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about those scenes at Old Trafford on Sunday and coping with social anxiety as we begin to exit the pandemic.
Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
Now, I know most people, when they hear that society is reopening, are up the walls making appointments and setting dates. Let's go for lunch. Let's do everything in a socially distanced way, but let's get out. But I suppose reopening of society and the economy also brings with us a little bit of anxiety, and that rate and level of anxiety will vary from person to person. Just to discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Dr. Oran McCarthy, who's Principal Clinical Psychologist, founder and indeed Director of Social Anxiety Ireland. Oran, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much for having me, Ciara.
Delighted to do so. I suppose the first inkling that this could be a widespread feeling, although again the depth of that feeling will vary from person to person and is a spectrum of feeling, came when we got all of those kites flown and just ahead of the cabinet meeting last Thursday about how we were going to reopen society over the coming weeks. And a lot of people, I saw people who may have a platform and people who don't, were saying, look, this is great, but I feel a little anxious about it.
I think, yes, there is a lot of ongoing anxiety about how the world will open up when it eventually does. And I suppose particularly, from my perspective, I focus on people with social anxiety. It's an interesting dilemma for them, to be honest with you. I think most people would have anticipated that the lockdown would have been an absolute nightmare for people with social anxiety, like it is for pretty much everyone else. But it's been a mixed bag. It's unusual. I think people with other kind of anxieties, particularly around infections and things like that, certainly will be impacted by something like a pandemic. But people with social anxiety, generally, unfortunately, one of the main ways of kind of sort of surviving the social world is to avoidance.
Mm.
And their lockdown actually gave them kind of permission almost to do so, which was interesting. I expected that there would be a harshness having to live during the lockdown period. But for many people, they've already been, engaged in a kind of social distancing prior to it. So this almost legitimised it for them. And for many people, it's a great deal of relaxation and kind of a reduction in stress.
And I would imagine, reduction in stress, I would say, was quite significant. And I don't mean this to sound flippant, but you're not constantly having to say to friends, to family, to colleagues, no, I don't want to go there. Exactly. No, I don't want to do this. I am quite happy in my home doing whatever it is that I enjoy doing without constantly having to fend off social interaction.
Yeah, no, I suppose in some ways you shouldn't get too confused between, people who are socially anxious and those who are introverted. Now, the introvert in some ways is quite happy to spend time on their own by out of choice. People with social anxiety often want to be out among other people or want to be socialising, but the fear associated with so high that they avoid, primarily to avoid the pain of that interaction, but they're not particularly happy at home either. I suppose there is a relief element in that they don't have to, but there's also a loneliness element that kicks in because they're not maybe naturally introvert where you might prefer to stay at home. So it's kind of different in that sense. And as I say, yes, up to now they've made lots of excuses not to, but they often felt it's not good for ourselves to be kind of constantly telling these kind of little white lies about can't make it or not good enough for me, or not a good time for me, whatever the excuse might be.
Ah, look, everybody has done it.
Yeah, I suppose we all do it to some extent. But it can wear them down, because this is really kind of, they'd be more excessive around this. So having a legitimate excuse actually made that easier.
Mm.
Now, those excuses begin to kind of limit. I suppose in many ways I used to, just didn't like that expression, social distancing. I much prefer if you call it physical distancing, it would have made better sense. The social distancing is almost kind of like, reduce social contact. So it was actually quite okay for a lot of people with social anxiety. For some who had been making progress, and working hard at getting kind of forward, I suppose, in their life with this, the lack of opportunity has knocked them back quite considerably. So they were doing nicely, I suppose, and then the lockdown occurred, and then their opportunity to practice, I suppose, in the social world was diminished. And I know a lot of those then are very concerned that they will have lost ground in some ways and have to kind of pick up the pieces further back along the line, which is a legitimate concern.
Mm. And it does mean that the coming weeks could be very difficult or certainly more difficult than people who don't experience social anxiety for those who do.
Oh, I think so. The expectation, I suppose, that everyone will want to meet everyone else when they can, and we'll get back to hugging and closer contact and face-to-face conversation. The kind of things that would normally have had people with social anxiety in a desperate state before, that's all beginning to happen again, with the expectation they're going to be there around that. And yes, after a year, I suppose, of a relief from all of that, with that kind of state function relief kind of going to one side, it is going to be more difficult for people to get back out and about if they have a background in social anxiety. No doubt about that.
Is there any way to smooth that difficulty? Are there steps in terms of preparedness that one could take, or ways in which, I don't want to say re-emerge, as we're all of us, I suppose, doing likewise, but as we re-engage together, is there practical ways that could be made a little bit easier for people who live with social anxiety?
Easier maybe, but definitely not pain-free. It's going to be anxiety-provoking as well. At some level, we've got to acknowledge that. So at a very basic level, I've been talking with our own support groups, talking to them about the need that they're going to have to push themselves somewhat, but they need to do it, balance that with a more of a gradual easing back into the social world to allow a bit of time to kind of build and some confidence to kind of build over that. Would be the kind of first thing I would say. Trying to find that need balance between, got to push it up a little bit, but not too much. Just kind of easing back, I think, would be a better way to do things. They're going to be kind of hit with the comparisons they tend to make, so I would say be careful of those comparisons. People with anxiety often feel that they need to be perfect in the social world, so I think they really need to work on this idea of being perfect, to drop that down as best they can and aim to be good enough within those kind of circumstances. That's a tall order, I know, but it's something I would be encouraging people to remember and to start working on. Reducing the amount of pressure on ourselves to be perfect actually makes it a little easier to defy the social world.
Well, Oran, you were saying?
Yeah. No, you want to have a question there? I was going to carry on if you wanted me to.
Unfortunately, time is somewhat against us, but thank you as ever for joining us this afternoon. That is Dr. Oran McCarthy, Principal Clinical Psychologist, Founder and Director of Social Anxiety Ireland. Do remember, we always want to hear from you. Get in touch with your comments, your requests, your dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97. Now, you will have heard in our news bulletins earlier that the Cabinet is debating a fairly controversial affordable housing bill, which I know the ESRI, some members of the opposition and the Central Bank have expressed fears will drive up the price of houses. Well, the price caps for affordable housing based on local authority areas have been released, and in what won't come as a surprise to many, Kildare is in the second tranche. So it's €350,000 for Kildare, Meath, Limerick, Galway and Cork, the highest cap. So beyond which a house won't be considered affordable is 400,000. That is in two of the Dublin local authorities, Cork, Galway and Wicklow. And then the lowest tranche is 225,000 in Cavan, Donegal, Leitrim, Longford, Mayo, Monaghan, Sligo and Tipperary. So certainly some very interesting figures there. Now, certainly concerning scenes at Old Trafford on Sunday. To discuss it, I'm joined on the line by Emma Duffy. She's a journalist at the 42.ie. Emma, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much, Ciara.
I would imagine casual observers or people who don't, you know, closely follow the Premier League might have assumed that this was something to do with the highly ill-fated, deeply controversial Super League. Not so.
No, well, in a way it kind of is. I suppose the Super League over the last few weeks is probably the straw that broke the camel's back, or, you know, this is why it's all kind of come to boiling point, because the Glazers, the Glazer family from America, United, the owners, have kind of been despised in the club for years now, and I think tensions have just come to an absolute height. And yeah, as you say, concerning scenes, I think, you know, the idea behind it was a peaceful protest, but like any of these kind of things, there's always going to be a few bad eggs and there's going to be bad headlines coming out of it. But yeah, look, it resulted in a match being postponed, United and Liverpool, which is obviously a massive match in the Premier League, and we don't know when that's going to happen now. So I don't know what happens next, but I think a statement has definitely been made.
And what's interesting about the Glazers now, I don't know an awful lot about them as a family, or indeed their other business dealings, but it does seem as in terms of their ownership of Manchester United, fans have never been particularly warm towards them.
No, I think, yeah, that's kind of it in a nutshell. Like, it is quite murky and complicated, but that's basically the take off it, that fans have never been quite warm to the Glazers, and there's obviously reasons behind that. You know, football has been made a lot more about money, and the thing is, the Glazers are making money off United, and the club is struggling. Like, they have money, so why is it not coming to the fore here? So that's probably a reason. I suppose football should be all about players and fans. We obviously know it's turned into much more than that. You know, it should be a game of two teams, a ball with two goals and trying to score, but obviously it is a big business now, and, you know, there's millions of euro and pound and whatever not in the game at the minute, and it's about much more than two teams playing football. But I think, I suppose, no one wants to see something like this happen, but I do feel like, as a football fan and a football person, like, it was probably necessary.
Well, what's interesting is, what were the fans hoping to achieve with that specific action? And B, ultimately what they want. Like, do they want the Premier League or English clubs in general to move towards a German model where they're fan-owned?
Yeah, it's hard to know. I think ultimately Manchester United fans want the Glazers out, and that's, I suppose, the long-running hashtag on Twitter, Glazers out. And, you know, you see the flags that they had at the stadium the other day. They just want the owners gone from the club. And then from there, I don't know what happens, like, because inevitably new owners come in and it's going to be massive billionaires and businessmen like the Glazers. But as you say, yeah, fan power is probably what's wanted. But I think Manchester United fans just want change, and they just don't want the people who are at the top there anymore, because, you know, it's only bringing the club down.
Philosophically speaking, should fans that don't, of any sport, of any club, of any commercial link to sporting outfit, have any say in the kind of owner that buys? So if I am a billionaire, Emma, and you are a fan of, you know, small town FC who just made it in the big time, and I buy that club, should you have a say in that?
I think so. Like, I think, I suppose, as I say, football is about players and fans, and it's about, you know, like Manchester United, Liverpool, all these clubs in the Premier League, they're seen as working class clubs for working class people. Like, that's what workers in the towns look forward to at weekends, going to watch their teams play football. I know we obviously can't do it at the minute with the COVID-19 pandemic, but that, at the end of the day, is kind of what these clubs are all about, and what, I suppose, everything at the club should probably revolve around. So yeah, I do think so. The one thing I think that's happened at United in particular is, like, supporters groups and supporters clubs aren't being listened to. You know, and that's obviously coming from the top down. But at United, there's been lots of developments in recent weeks in the wake of the Super League. Ed Woodward resigned, obviously a big name in Manchester United, and one that I suppose fans are happy to see come to a head. And I think that's probably now why the fact that Woodward is going, they think that hopefully they can get the Glazers out as well. But, you know, it's a lot more complicated than that. It's all well and good them going to protest and trying to make a point, but there's a lot more at play here.
Well, there's a lot more to happen here before this plays out, certainly. Emma Duffy, journalist at the42.ie, thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, I'll be joined by Kildare North Sinn Féin TD Raida Cronin, and we will be talking about the disparity between information she received from the HSE and data on pregnant women contracting COVID-19. Now, in mid-April, if not a little bit before, Kildare North Sinn Féin TD Raida Cronin joined me on this programme after posing questions of the Minister for Health whether new information or clinical presentations were emerging suggesting pregnancy does or could put women at a particular or greater risk of serious complications. It's taken quite some time for that reply to come in. It filtered through Stephen Donnelly and thence on to the HSE, and it was given to Deputy Cronin 2 days before new information emerged showing an enormous surge in the women who've contracted COVID between the first and third wave of infection here. And to discuss this, I'm joined online by Deputy Raida Cronin. Raida, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Ciara, and thank you very much for coming back to this important matter as well.
Not at all. Those figures released by the Irish Independent and the Master of the Rotunda Hospital yesterday were absolutely staggering, and they do provide context for this discussion. So in the first wave, 189 women who were pregnant contracted COVID-19. In the third wave, it's over 1,000, yet the HSE says what to you?
The HSE, I received a letter, it was late Friday evening, I received a reply from the HSE to one of my questions that I had put in, asking about new information or clinical presentations emerging, asking that put pregnant women at greater risk of serious complications. And I got the reply anyway. Pregnant women are no more likely to be diagnosed with COVID-19 in comparison to non-pregnant women, which makes sense because, you know, you're either going to catch, being pregnant isn't going to make you more liable to catch COVID. But if you are diagnosed with COVID-19, they are slightly more likely to have serious complications than non-pregnant women. And that, you know, is... On Monday, I wasn't satisfied with the answer, to be honest with you, because I knew just that the numbers were higher and that they were disproportionate to the number of ordinary women in the
general population. Yeah.
Yes. but I saw this yesterday morning, the piece in the Independent there. Yesterday morning was a bank holiday morning. There's some Professor Fergal Malone, the master of the in the Rotunda Hospital, where he had said that there were 189 in the first round pregnant women, and that number had gone up to 1147 women who were more than, and with 131 of those needing intensive care treatment. Like, that's a huge jump. And I think the question, I was, last time I was on with you, I was talking to you about a question I had raised last November, where they were seeing a significant increase in pregnant women in the UK. And obviously, it, perhaps it has something to do with the new B117 variant.
It might seem logical on the basis of the times at which these instances have occurred to create a link between that and B117. Neither you nor I are epidemiologists, so yeah. I mean, that is speculation on our part, but the figures speak for themselves. So 131
because the increase had happened in the UK when they had that B117 variant, and they do say in the reply to me that in the reply that there is, that there might be some kind of it might be to do, because the reply they gave me in November said there was no difference, but there was an increase in England where they had the B117 variant, but in this last final wave it has seemed to have affected pregnant women more so.
And there's a number of matters of concern, right? I suppose I'll take the easiest to counter first, and that's the HSE's characterising this as a slight increase in probability of complications. And I'm acutely aware that the person who is in the HSE was not issuing you a clinical opinion based on medical experience and fact, but rather this is a written opinion based on information within the HSE. But slight rater means one thing to you and another thing to me.
Well, slightly more likely to have serious complications than non-pregnant women, whereas in the Independent, Fergal Malone, the master of the Rotunda, says that it's significant. Now, there's a big difference between significant and slightly more likely. And, you know, the HSE should be giving the information. Is the information the facts? Are the facts? They should. This is. I requested this information in a public forum. You know, PQs. This is public information. And why are they giving me different information to what they are giving the master of the Rotunda Hospital? Why are they giving different information to me than what they are giving to the media?
And that information released to the master of the Rotunda Hospital shows that over 10% of women who contracted COVID whilst pregnant in this current wave of infection ended up in ICU. So 131 out of 1,147. And as you've already pointed out, Rhaida, that is a higher proportion than in the general population. So what now should be done?
Well, they have. After I was talking to you last week, actually, a few obstetricians did contact me, and they were very pleased to see this being raised in the media, because they were trying to impress upon NIAC the importance of offering the vaccine to the two pregnant women. And David Cullinan also raised this in the door to me at a health committee for me, because it's very. Sorry, only members of committees can go to committees at the moment because they're restricted to 2 hours. Mm. So David Cullinan, the Sinn Féin health spokesperson, did raise that for me. And it has resulted in NIAC recommending that pregnant women between 6 weeks and, I think, 36 will be offered the mRNA vaccine. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of information now globally around this, and you know, if they have any safety concerns, they should speak to their doctors and their obstetricians.
Do you draw some comfort from that, Rhaida, or do you think it's taken a lot of a hard slog to get to that point and an awful lot of data?
I think it has. I think it has, Ciara. I don't know if, you know, we talk about women in politics, women bringing up women's issues, but we certainly, I was very grateful to be on the radio with you there last week, about this, and raising these kinds of issues, because, you know, when I was on to you last week, I said that you know, this country, this state, has a very poor record in how they treat women, and particularly pregnant women. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it's made a difference, but I did, you know, say to you, thank you for having, for raising this and bringing me on KFM and discussing this, because it is important that these things are raised. You know, I saw Sarah McInerney saying that every time she looks at a podium, there's a man there speaking. And it's, you know, it's important to raise these issues because, you know, this isn't just a woman's issue. This is the family issue. Yeah. This is an issue for families. It's an issue for husbands, partners, parents, siblings. You know, it's important to everybody across the record, but it's important for us to bring it up.
Well, Kildare North Sinn Féin TD Radio Cronin, thank you as always for your time and indeed your work on this particular topic.